Hi, I'm Matthew Barrett.
And I'm Taylor Romans, and this is Hard Beeswax, Experiences in Waldorf Education.
This week on Hard Beeswax, Taylor and I speak with Rosa Vela Sachs, a retired Waldorf Spanish teacher and queen of the universe.
If you are enjoying the work that we are doing here on the Hard Beeswax podcast, please consider making a financial contribution on our Patreon account, which can be found on our website, hardbeeswax.transistor.fm.
If a financial contribution is not in the cards for you, please share our episodes with friends, family, neighbors, or any others who you think might enjoy our show. We thank you all for listening.
We are individuals who are a part of this global educational movement, and we want to be clear that we are only speaking from our own experiences and impressions. We do not presume to speak for the Waldorf movement as a whole. Today on Hard Beeswax, we're so excited to be joined with the queen of the universe herself.
Oh my goodness.
Senora Vela Sachs, or Rosa Vela Sachs. I have a particular connection with Rosa because she was my Spanish teacher for 8 years, which is pretty incredible looking back on that.
And yeah, nice.
You were just always such a vibrant, larger-than-life presence in the classroom, and we were a bit of a wily group of young people, and you just wrangled us right into shape. So,
you were so much fun. You were so much fun.
Well, it's just really lovely to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for asking. I really appreciate it.
So maybe we typically like to start, especially with people who became Waldorf teachers, with the question of what was your own experience like as a student going to school?
I grew up in South Texas, and I attended public schools for the most part. It was a way to get away from the house. I mean, I grew up in a big family. There were 9 kids in the house, and so I was used to being in big groups, and that was fine with me. But moreover, school gave me an opportunity for autonomy, which I didn't really have at home because I was pretty well monitored. So, yes, I enjoyed school. I wasn't particularly interested in becoming a teacher. I didn't think I would. It was something I was not. I mean, my parents kept saying, be a teacher, be a teacher. And it's something that's been in the family for, we have everybody's teachers in my family. And I resisted being the rebel that I am. But it's something that just happened organically for me, becoming a teacher.
Oh.
So school was okay. I mean, I really feel that I got my formative education at the Austin Waldorf School.
Hmm.
I felt like that's where I got my education.
And did you start teaching at the Austin Waldorf School, or what was the process of finding the Austin Waldorf School?
Okay, well, I didn't start teaching at the Austin Waldorf School. I started in Dallas. The first time I encountered Waldorf was in Dallas, Texas, when my children, my own 2 sons, were toddlers.
Oh.
At that time, it was out of my reach financially.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up going to a public Montessori school. Mm. And I became involved with that, but I was still very attracted to Waldorf. So I read Steiner, and I read books about Waldorf curriculum in education. And then we decided to go sailing, and I homeschooled my kids for a couple of years doing that. And when we decided to come back to land, we landed in Austin. And I saw an ad in the paper for the position at the Austin Waldorf School.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, oh, that's something I've done before. Because I had taught with a small company in Dallas, the language connection. We taught in different private schools.
Okay.
That's how I started. And then when I got to Austin and saw that ad, I just took a chance, and they took a chance on me, and I think it worked out pretty well for both of us.
Yeah. So when you first then came into a Waldorf classroom, what was that experience like for you? Because you'd read about it, you were familiar about the ideas, but probably then being there, going into a classroom, felt pretty different.
Oh, I think it's a universal. Well, I think for the most part, I've heard most people say that it's like magic. It's like entering a world of magic, fairy tale world. And it was, but it was more than that. It was really a space where that was prepared, much like in Montessori, that the space was prepared. But moreover, there was more. There was a this opportunity to go into your one's imagination, one's creative realms, you know, whereas, you know, Montessori, I love Montessori too, but it's much more practical. It has a much more, you know, A equals B sort of trajectory than Waldorf does. Waldorf is a more holistic education that engages all of the senses. And that to me was, that was electric. Wow. So yeah, it was really magical.
And what grades did you teach?
I started teaching first through eighth grade, and then I incorporated, then my second year I taught the ninth grade also, but we decided that wasn't really where I wanted to be or where I needed to be. And then I incorporated kindergarten. So I thought I taught the kindergarten through the eighth grade.
Wow.
I've also taught adults now because I've conducted some workshops and conferences for the Sound Circle in Seattle. And Fair Oaks in California.
Yeah.
And I've done some workshops for different organizations. So I've had experience teaching adults now too.
Wow.
So I'm curious because, like you are saying, Waldorf asks for this really holistic set of skills from a teacher. And I do remember you as having a beautiful singing voice, of being an amazing artist. I mean, that's how I remember seeing you as a kid. But was that something already at play in your life that you'd used? Or was that something you had the opportunity to tap into once you started teaching at the Waldorf School?
They were both two things that I already did for myself. I was already painting and drawing. And singing was something I've always liked to do. It was something that my family was into also. So on I think a memorable story for my colleagues has been that when I went to apply, that the day that I interviewed with the whole faculty, they asked me if I liked to sing. And I said, yes, would you like to hear a song? And I sang a song for them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them now say that that's what sealed the deal for them, that I sang Granada for them.
It's amazing. So when you came into teaching Spanish, was there around Waldorf schools an understanding of here is what the foreign language curriculum should look like in a Waldorf school? Was that really alive and at play, or was that something that you really had to bring out of yourself, your knowledge of child development, of how a language is learned? Can you talk a little bit about what that process was like for you?
Yes, when I started teaching, there were some, I'm going to say, vague indications that written by Steiner of what a foreign language class or a second language class should be. And that was all we had to go by. So we grasped onto those. I was very fortunate that my first 2 weeks as an employee of the Waldorf School, the Austin Waldorf School, they sent me to Massachusetts, to the Lexington School, to observe and work with Mar Guzman, who was my mentor, an amazing teacher. And she filled me in those 2 weeks. She filled me with everything that she knew that worked for her. And then she encouraged me to return to Austin and make it my own. Indications were very vague about what a second language class should be, lesson should be. But I think through the years, more and more teachers have begun to see that foreign languages or second languages are integral to the methodology of Waldorf.
Yes.
They are so integral that more and more form has been given to what they think is a healthy, I'm not going to say what's supposed to be, because I think there's a danger when we become too dogmatic or too attached to the indications or the parameters of what we teach. Mm. But it does need to take some shape. And I think it has become a more graspable curriculum now than it used to be. But when I started, there was nothing. Mm. There was no curriculum. It did really totally come out of the teacher. So for those first few years, I felt like, you know, both the kids and I were flying by the seat of our pants. But boy, that was fun. What a ride.
What year did you first start teaching? I'm just curious of who that group of students was when you were there for your first year.
I started teaching. Your class was my second year.
Oh, wow.
So I started teaching in 1996.
Yeah.
Musselman?
Yeah. Yeah, because we were 97.
So,
wow.
Yeah, you were my second class.
That's incredible. And I can speak to the fact that now there really are some incredible resources for teaching Spanish as a second language in Waldorf schools. My first job at the Santa Fe Waldorf School was as one of my first jobs was an elementary Spanish teacher. And I will have you know, Rosa, I went into that demo class, fourth grade, and I said, okay, what do I remember from Señora de la Sax? And I'm busting out mi cuerpo, I'm busting out la vaca lechera. And then they gave me the job and I had to start Monday and I said, oh no, I just use all my tricks. But I did get to go to the Waldorf Spanish Teachers Association conference and it was incredible. And there are really, really beautiful, amazing resources. And I think that something that always struck me as being so distinct, and maybe you could elaborate on this, was that this idea of just letting the children like be washed in the language and the culture. And I think back to you and, you know, you would wear traditional blouses and the skirts and even just visually, you were so much a representative of the way that the Spanish speaking culture of people in South Texas, in our area, the way that it was visually in our lives. Could you speak a little bit about maybe that part of the second language curriculum?
I'm grateful that you noticed that I was trying to wear the traditional clothing, because now when I think back at it, I think, God, I just went overboard. but it was fun, you know, and for the kids to get to see what it looked like. I felt at the time it was right for the times. I think now I think back on it, and I think it's important that kids who are learning a second language, they see these traditional things, but also see us as a modern people.
Yeah.
Because
and a
we,
modern
if
language.
We get stuck in these stereotypes of what it's supposed to be, that can be dangerous too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was so much fun to wear all those clothes and to have the kids admire them. You know, it was fun.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about just, you know, second language or modern languages within the Waldorf school? Because growing up, my school had German and French. It was Green Meadow and on the East Coast. And I know that there are some schools at Santa Fe Waldorf, we actually had Spanish and Chinese for a while. And is the foreign language just related to the locale of the school? And what are the languages around it? Or how, you know, what is there any, what are the indications? Or how does a school or the Waldorf movement, you know, think about, you know, modern languages or second languages?
Traditionally, the school tasked with picking those things to teach that lived for the children in the area they were in. And then as they develop, as they mature, we go further and further out into the world. So, for example, in Austin, the two languages that are very much part of the geography here and the culture are German and Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the years, we have people wanting us to teach Chinese and Japanese, and that's all well and good. I thought that the more languages a child learns, the better. But we didn't have the resources at the time, and there wasn't enough interest in those languages to offer them here. We felt that these two languages were what lived for us. Mm-hmm. In Seattle, the two languages that were taught were Spanish and Chinese, Spanish and Japanese, because those languages live very strongly there.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the first indications of why those languages are chosen, because they live in the land, in the geography of wherever the school is placed.
Mm.
Nowadays, I think because we're becoming such a global civilization, I feel like it's okay to offer something like Japanese in a place where it might not be spoken a lot. Mm-hmm. If that's the only option that a school has.
Yeah.
Better to offer a language, a second language, even if it doesn't live there, than not to offer one at all.
Yeah.
Right.
Because I think the important is that experience of learning a second language and a third language and a fourth. You know, I think that's what's important. Learning a language creates different neurological pathways in our thinking. But the way that it's, and you can do that in any school. What makes Waldorf different is that it engages the entire being in the learning of the language. So to the point that it becomes a habit for the child and it becomes second nature. I was so incredibly proud when I heard you were teaching Spanish at the Santa Fe Waldorf School. So incredibly proud. And I kept wanting to reach out to you to say, oh, Taylor, whatever you need, I'm here. And I hope you knew that.
Yes.
But at the same time, I felt it was so critical that you carry what you had yourself. You already had it. You did not need me for that. And so, but I'm so proud of you.
Oh, thank you. Well, and it's so, I think this topic is so close to home for me because I, you know, had Spanish through 12 years. And in many cases, by the time we got to high school, we were interacting with the language in a very academic way. Mm-hmm. But I didn't quite feel confident that I could walk into a Spanish-speaking establishment and just navigate conversation fluidly. But then mm-hmm. when I got to college, I took Spanish and kept taking Spanish and kept taking Spanish. And then eventually I went to Costa Rica. And when I was there, it happened so fast. And I didn't think that I was as close to fluency as I ended up being because it was just all in me.
Right.
And
and when I was going through that experience of, you know, it was looking back, it's so funny. I think I was 20 and I was the only gringa in this whole farm. All of my coworkers were, you know, these older Costa Rican men, and who knows what they were, you know, what they were saying to me throughout the workday, but I really needed to understand as soon as possible. And so there was this, you know, fire lit in me to learn, and I realized how much vocabulary I had, how much of the accent and just the musical sound of it I had. And it just kind of became a leap of courage. And then I didn't fall. And, you know, and I spent a lot of time in that experience. I ended up getting my degree in Spanish because I said, oh, okay, whatever I do in the world, then I'll be bilingual. And as, you know, a 6 foot tall white woman, you're not, you know, I'm not necessarily the person who most people would see as being Spanish speaking or assume would be Spanish speaking, but it ended up being an incredible gift that went with me for the rest of that I've carried with me and continue to use on a regular basis. And I think so much of that comes from the way that in elementary school, Spanish did not feel academic. I don't know how to say that, but and maybe you can speak to why that is, but I don't look back on it like puzzling through a math problem. You know, that it was more of a guided experience and less of like a presentation of information that you were expected to leave understanding, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what you're saying does resonate for me. I think it really talks about kind of the exchange. And some schools have international exchange programs or not. But for just to talk about my biography a little bit, I also studied two languages, French and German, starting in first grade. And then we were rambunctious enough that in seventh grade, we had to choose one language. And I continued with German. And then by 10th grade, I went to Germany for 7 months. And so those 7 months in 10th grade, you know, I probably, as you said, all that was in me and it all woke up. And by the time I left, I definitely could pass for, I wasn't sure if I was totally fluent, but I could definitely pass for a German speaker.
And you're both testaments to Waldorf education and the way languages work when they work at a Waldorf school.
Yeah, because it didn't feel intellectual. Like, I mean, it was at that point in 10th grade, but it was already like, oh, yeah, I know the vocabulary, or I've, you know, played a game that, you know, or something. It was like, it was in a different part of my body. Like it was in my muscles almost or something.
Exactly in your muscles. When in the first through the third grade, what we're tasked to do as Waldorf teachers in a foreign language is to put the language in the children's body. So anything having to do with movement, hand games, you know, jumping and running and dancing and singing, anything that has to do with movement, we're putting that language in their bodies, and that's how they'll remember it. And then once they get into the fourth grade and their brains start to wake up a little bit, then that's when we get into the academics. That's when you start to introduce more, at least that was traditionally. Now I'm seeing that more and more schools are introducing the written word and more academics earlier. Mm-hmm. And at first, when I saw that some of the teachers that I mentor were doing this, I resisted. I thought, well, wait, what are you doing there? It's too soon. But, you know, I don't know. One of the questions in your list is about how I see changes or how I saw changes in children. And maybe I'm jumping the gun, but I'm going to say this here. I think we need to be very conscious of how we're evolving, not only as a civilization, but as individuals. I mean, certainly at a Waldorf school, we look at the evolution or the development of the child through that lens, but we have to be more global about it, because I think we have a tendency to say, okay, well, this is how we've been doing it, and this is how it works, and this is how it has to be. But our children, we're born for the times. We are born for the times. And these children who are coming into the world, they're born for their time, and we need to address their needs, not make them meet our expectations and standards.
Absolutely.
So you see a speeding up of that process, or what?
I see a change happening in how we synthesize and take in information, not just languages, but all. And maybe it has to do with the exposure to, I don't know, you know, more exposure to everything.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
And I'm not, I don't know. I'm not, I don't claim to be the ultimate authority, of course. I'm just sharing what my perspective and what I think
absolutely
is happening.
Yeah, no, I mean, the show is experiences and Waldorf education, and everyone's experience, I think, has a kernel of truth in it. And I too see that there was in math and science where I taught, there did seem to be an acceleration happening. And it was like, okay, do I start where I usually started back, you know, with Galileo in the 1500s? And then my classes would probably, you know, just make it to the 20th century. And we were already at the end of the 20th century. So there was this big question in my teaching life to be like, how do we accommodate the 20th century? And do we just start, you know, how do we not start with Galileo, or do we go through what he did faster, or, you know? I'm sure that's probably the same in a language class too.
Yeah.
It's having to choose, you know, what do these students need? And it's very easy, you know, there's a lot of really wonderful resources, as you say, but sometimes a teacher might look at those resources and say, this is it.
This is the way.
And, right. And they might forget that they have to look at who's in front of them and what they need. Mm-hmm. So I'm really curious to hear how you resolved your Galileo versus the 20th century situation.
It was a living question is how I would say. I don't think I resolved it. It was always just, maybe I don't spend 5 days, you know, maybe I spend a little bit less, but then I actually tended to assign individual research projects into the 20th century because, you know, it often, I think the answer was more to individualize, especially at the high school level.
Yeah.
So it was like, oh, you want to talk about modern physics? Okay, you do a research project and you know,
putting it into their hands
and their enthusiasm. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, that works. That's good.
And I
like that.
I think too that I found that I think, like you've talked about, Rosa, in Waldorf education, it's very easy for things to kind of become too crystallized, right? Of too solid. And what I found was a lot of the vehicles, like the book or the story or the song that were used, that I remember being used to get into a certain topic or to get into a certain set of questions, that some of those didn't seem to work for the kids in front of us. And you know, I always think of the example where I had a 9th grade English class. We were talking about the novel. The tradition was to do a lot of older novels that are incredible, that someone should read in their lifetime. But so much time was spent trying to just kind of shove these kids into this old language and into this story that they had a really hard time entering, when why not give them a contemporary story that has really interesting themes that they just like to read, and then say, hey, you are liking to read this story, and let's talk about all of these elements that are at work in it. And
yeah.
And I think that, you know, there's always this balance of, you know, if your students like cartoons, you don't want to bring cartoons in lieu of a, you know, in lieu of another story. But there is something to be said for, like you're saying, who is in front of you? Who are these children, and what do they need? How do I teach them what they need going into the future, not what I needed when I was them.
I think that particularly in a language class, it's a conversation between the teacher and the students. It can't be just the teacher talking to the students. It has to be a conversation. So if you don't listen to what your children, what your students are asking or needing, if you don't pay attention to that, you're going to lose them. Mm-hmm. You have to give them, and it's a balance. You know, as you say, you know, if they want cartoons all the time, that's not good either.
Yeah.
So we have to challenge, we have to channel what their needs with what they want. You know, I've lost the...
No, it definitely sounds to me like the conversation I've often had between form and freedom, right? In a Waldorf context. So, but that begs the question of, is the teacher looking through a lens like, okay, there's a form that I want to bring, but there's some freedom in how that's brought. And if it's this book or that book, or, you know, I think that's where, for me, it gets down to kind of the devilish details a little bit. You know, I think when you're trained as a Waldorf teacher, you understand a phrase like form and freedom, and you might have applied it in your class, but how do you not just go back and say, well, you know, 4 years ago this worked and now I'm going to, you know, I'm just going to try it again. You know, there's kind of a cop out. There's an easy way out, and then there's the actual hard work that I think is asked of the teachers, is to really look at that class every day. And how do you do that?
Every day. Every day. Yeah. No, but I hear what you're saying. Absolutely. You know, this worked 4 years ago that I'm going to keep doing because it worked 4 years ago. And some of it will, you know, some of it will, but you have to keep changing it. It has to keep altering. You know, I'm trying to think of an example in my teaching of where that might have worked. There was a game that I used to play or a song I used to teach. I don't remember it, Taylor, maybe you didn't get it in class. It was Bate Bate Chocolate.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And we would just list, we would, you know, try to do it one way, and we were trying to list, do it one way, and it wasn't working. And so finally I started to do it with hand clapping, and that worked. And so I used that for years and years and years. That was third grade. The last third grade I taught in Seattle, it wasn't working. Huh. And nothing I did. You know, they just weren't connecting to this, and I couldn't figure it out because I kept thinking, well, if the teacher has a connection to it, they're going to want to do it. And I was stuck with this, and I had to just put that aside and I'll leave it alone. You know, I didn't try it again with them. I just left it alone. The next year I tried it again just to see where one of those moments where, you know, you're standing in front of the class and you're like, oh, what do I do now?
Yeah.
And it worked, and they loved it. It's the group, you know, you know, you have to be able to stand there. You have to be vulnerable, you know, and let yourself be vulnerable and say, okay, this isn't working. Let's change.
Yeah.
And sometimes right there in the classroom, you know, right there.
And to have a toolbox, right? Oh, this isn't working. Let me try this. I mean, that's often a sign of a more experienced teacher, right?
Definitely.
That's true.
Being able to have all that stuff just waiting. So I would love to give you a chance to talk a little bit about maybe your curriculum as it unfolded from first to eighth grade, and maybe what were some of the elements, what were some of the things that, what were some of your favorite parts of it? Because I really do think that you know, like I think of the folk dancing, you know, which I loved so much.
Yes, you guys were amazing with that. And we've got to acknowledge Erlinda Vanderlinder because she was the teacher there.
Yeah.
And she did an amazing job with you. Oh, I have a CD of that. Have you ever seen that?
No, I've never seen it.
I have a CD of all those folk dances. Somebody, I don't know who took it. Somebody surreptitiously took it because we weren't allowed to record this. But yes, that was amazing. And they learned, her class learned Jarabe Tapatío, which is an incredibly difficult folk dance. But they were amazing. I still remember, you know, the boys with their footwork, and it was beautiful.
Yeah, it was a highlight.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, this was fourth, fifth, sixth, it was third, fourth, and fifth grade?
Well, it was first through eighth grade did a folk dance.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Each class did a different folk dance.
You know.
Starting with the simplest one, mm-hmm. and then eighth grade was El Tapatío, and that was just, wow.
Yeah, and I think it was, you know, there's such a fine line with middle schoolers of giving them opportunities to take on something really, really challenging. But I think there's also a maybe cultural developmental safety net to where if it gets too hard and weird, then they just don't try, you know, and that's kind of the fallback. And somehow it just tapped into some part of us, and we just worked so hard on that.
Your class needed that. Class needed it. It was a very strong class, very strong energy, very willful, but oh my goodness, so intelligent and eloquent, you know, and they needed the physical. They needed something that to get them moving and get them active, and that interaction in the dancing between the couples, it was just exactly what they needed.
Wow.
So you asked about how I developed my curriculum, or at the start, it was just whatever the previous teacher had written down on a yellow pad.
Yeah.
And she was a great teacher, but her curriculum was this yellow pad that had just some indications to what, you know. So I went by that the first couple of years, and then slowly added as I learned, as I became more informed as to what I was supposed to be doing, as I read more. And I had some great mentors. I had there at the school itself, there were some amazing teachers who I was allowed to go and observe. And I spent a lot of time observing them so I would get an idea. And then I formed my curriculum. I designed it based on what I read about the main lesson curriculum, because I think really helps to, the students already have the form for that. They already have already shaped. And all the teacher has to do is go in and apply the different language, you know, with some excitement. And I think that worked really well. But in first to third grade, like I said, we address mostly the memory. We're teaching them a habit. We're not, as Taylor says, it's not an intellectual or academic subject. It's a habit we're developing. So things that they have to do over and over and over again, and the things don't change. There's like four different topics for the year, and you know, you do the same thing. It might get really boring for the teacher, but the children are learning, you know. And you don't leave it. You make it interesting by changing it every now and then, or changing the dynamic of how it works. And then fourth and fifth are the bridge years, where the students are beginning to leave that fairy tale, that, you know, etheric realm, and they're getting earthed, and they start to doubt the adults around them. They start to really, you know, look at us and say, well, you know, we're not perfect.
Yeah.
And
how do you
know? That's where the Norse myths are so perfect for them. And so you look at that and you work with that in a language class. That translates into playing with the language, tongue twisters, word games, nonsense things. Oh, because they love nonsense, and being willing to laugh at them and to let them laugh at you.
Yeah.
That's very important. That's, I remember the time that I broke a chair in the fourth grade playing a game, and they never let me forget that. I think it was in their eighth grade presentation about Señora Bella Sachs breaking a chair. And I sat down and broke the chair. And then once they get into sixth grade, and the darkness of the dark ages gets into them, then you really need to start going and seeing the world. And so geography and traveling and different cultures becomes important. Also allowing them an opportunity to develop a different identity, because if they are trying to, this is when they begin to push against, I mean, parenthood is a lifetime of labor pains. You know, they're always pushing against you.
Yeah. You know?
My mother-in-law is fond of saying that it's only the first 40 years of parenthood that are difficult. You know, it gets easier after that. And I can attest to that. But so in sixth grade, they start to really, for one thing, they're being drawn down by the earth forces. And so they start to get kind of melancholic for the most part. I'm not everybody, but, you know, some students. So to meet them with geography and more, you know, travel is a great thing for them.
Yeah.
And then once they get past the eighth grade, then that's when their intellect really starts to come out. And that's when they can really own it for themselves. You still need to study it, because by the time they get to 15, a lot of the students will say to me, I didn't learn anything in first and eighth grade.
Yeah.
And then they come back to me as seniors to say, wow, you would be surprised, you know, what I know.
So, yeah, I get that from my math students who don't remember their times tables.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that is so funny. The ninth grade, you're right. They come in, they're like, I don't know if we ever learned that. I'm like, yeah. You did.
Yeah.
You did learn it.
Well, the difference is that it is, they've developed a habit for it.
Yeah.
They tasted it emotionally. You know, they developed a habit as a tiny child. They tasted it emotionally in middle school, whether in a positive or negative way, because you do have to do that pull and, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That between the emotions. So now in the, when it reaches the intellect, it has to come back, but it has to come back in the brain or in the head. And the only way to draw it to, how can I say this?
Through consciousness?
What comes out is because it's everything that's already been built up with, you know, in the heart and the limbs.
Yeah.
That is so interesting.
Yeah.
And I
had two students who, after they graduated from high school, decided to travel. One of them had been offered Ian Pollard a job in South America, Peru, teaching photography. And so he and his good friend Canyon Darcy went traveling through Mexico and South America. And they, you know, they had been since second grade with me through eighth grade, and then they'd studied in high school. But it wasn't until they got to Mexico that I got an email from Ian saying, Rosa, I'm dreaming in Spanish.
Yeah.
And I know that I own the language now because I'm dreaming in Spanish. And they were so proud of themselves because people kept asking them all through South America and Latin America, you know, what part of Mexico they were from.
Yeah.
You know, where in Mexico had they grown up? And they kept saying, no, we're we speak English. We're Americans or we're gringos or whatever. And so they were so proud, and I was very proud.
Yeah, you're so right that experience where it does go through everything, because when you're in early elementary school, in many ways it is unconscious, right? It enters unconsciously, and then then you have an emotional relationship with it in middle school, and then in high school it becomes intellectual, but then it almost has to return back to becoming unconscious again.
Right.
For it to flow.
Yes.
And I remember that the thing that I unlocked was not having to think about it. Like where I just, even if I didn't know the word, it didn't hold me up. I just explained what I was trying to say. And then someone would tell me the word and I'd just slide it right in. And then the next time I would, you know, but
yeah, you're right. That's it. That's it.
That's,
yeah, I agree.
That's so interesting. Wow. Wow.
So how does kindergarten fit then? Because you said you went down and started teaching in kindergarten. So is that more rhythmic games and stuff?
In the kindergarten, it's even less than that. I taught for each group for about 15 minutes, and it was a circle. And it was the same little poem, same little song, same little story every time.
Oh, yeah, right.
Every time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't so much about them learning, although they would, you know. I remember having parents who would pick up their children after school and say, well, what did you learn in Spanish today?
Yeah.
And the child would go, I don't know. and then the parent would be so disappointed. I'm paying all this money for them to go to the school where they're learning languages and they're not learning.
Yeah.
And then bath time comes around. The child's in the bathtub singing in Spanish.
Yeah.
You know, this complete song in Spanish. And the mother comes back and, you're singing in Spanish. You know? What are you saying?
Hello. Yeah.
So it's just about training their mouths to form the words and making a habit for that. And so that they can become familiar with a language teacher. And when first grade hits and they're hit with all of this new information that they're not used to, at least they know this one person that they've met, and they might feel a little bit more comfortable with her.
Right.
That's
so
really,
that was basically it for the kindergarten.
I think that's really beautiful, because I think the reality is that the things that enter at that age are so powerful, and to have the sounds of another language.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I even with Oren, I mean, I speak a little bit of Spanish with him. I have a couple of, we have some children's books in Spanish, and the other day he got a stuffed animal horse, and I said, what do you want to name your horse? Because he's just started naming things. And he said, Salty. And he already has, he already named his little stick horse, you know, Salty. And so I said, well, you know, you already have a horse named Salty. Is there another name? And he looks at me and says, Arroz.
Like, I love that.
Arroz? Like, where did you get that? And I guess I probably just offhandedly had mentioned, you know, that we're having arroz for dinner, you know, and so he now has a horse named Arroz. But
that's great.
You know, I mean, I just, and one thing I always heard when I got to college was that in general, I had a pretty good accent. And I think that was something that came from those first grade years of, yes. Oh my gosh, I feel like we used to spend entire classes doing el ferrocarril, carril, carril, like this like chanting marching game where you would do like 5 steps forward and 3 steps back and 5 steps forward. And we would just all be in a line going and going and going. And those things, like you're right, just getting the words on your tongue and familiar and, you know, practicing the sounds, it really makes a huge difference later.
I think it does, yeah.
If you were imagining talking to a parent who had a young child coming into the Waldorf school who was saying, you know, I feel like my child is learning so slowly. You know, what are they actually learning in these lower grades? What would you say to help that parent maybe understand what the bigger picture at work is?
My standard spiel for that, because that was one of the main questions in every parent morning, was that in these lower grades, we're just developing a habit for the language. We're developing their appreciation for other cultures, for other ways of being, for other ways of living, you know, that there's a possibility for, you know, the sky. Right now, in English, it's sky, but in Spanish, it's cielo. And what's, you know, even kids, even at that age, will start to look at that and start to make connections between that. So for those grades, that's what I say. It's a habit. You know, mm-hmm. Don't expect anything. Don't ask them anything. If they share with you, be grateful. And, you know, have faith. Faith in the process because it works. Mm-hmm. And then I would name several people that I knew, like Taylor or Canyon or Ian Pollard or other students who I knew had succeeded, you know, who were doing this in Spanish. And it was because of how they learned it in the lower grades. For the most part, that parents want to believe that. And they do have faith. They do put their children in Waldorf schools because they do have faith in this method.
Yeah.
And if they don't, if they lose faith, then they don't last in the school. And, you know, Susan Darcy, a great friend and colleague, used to say to us that people are either running to whatever Waldorf is offering or running away from something. You know, they're either running towards something or trying to get away from something else, you know, that doesn't make sense. It doesn't sound right the way I said it. They're running to something or running away from something.
It makes sense to me that.
Okay, good.
and I think we all saw that, or I feel like I saw that as a teacher, that you had a lot of, especially in the high school, you would have families come to the high school, no knowledge of Waldorf education, except for the fact that it wasn't where they'd been before.
Exactly.
Right? Whereas you also have other people who have, you know, since the moment they had a tiny squealing baby in their arms, started reading about this thing and, you know, come in with a real desire for that is the thing that I want.
Right.
Yeah, I'd love to go back a step and just talk about, I think another important thing that happens in the early grades, perhaps, is, you know, the tuning of one's ear to a language. I'm not sure if that's, I mean, I'm totally just, I think that's what happens, but.
No, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. One of the greatest resources I ever read was, I don't know, I can't name the author right now, but the title of the book is The 12th Census, or 12 Senses. Mm-hmm. And I think that that book is an amazing resource for language teachers because it really helps you to understand how, you know, how the body works and how language and how communication works in our body. We're surrounded by languages. Waldorf School is a school about communication and languages. And music is a language. Mathematics are a language. Dancing is a language. You know, everything is a language in a Waldorf school. It's just a different way of learning it.
Yeah.
We the language teachers, I think the biggest challenge was that we were tasked with doing the exact same thing the class teacher was doing but in another language and in only 45 minutes twice a week.
Yeah.
So it's a challenge. So really, you have to, I felt a lot of times I have to really pull back on what I wanted to do because
yes.
I was limited by the time and by, you know, sometimes there were times when if something had to give, the first thing to go was the language class.
Yeah.
And then you weren't able to finish your block. And then there was the complaint about, well, they didn't learn anything because, you know, so it's a real challenge. I think it's teaching languages as a language. And maybe every single Waldorf teacher feels this way, but to me, it's the hardest job in a Waldorf school.
Yeah.
Because the expectations are great. I mean, this teacher that I'm mentoring now in Costa Rica was telling me that her school, they're just starting. It's a very small school. But she was saying that the school's goal for the end of the year is fluency. And they just started. And I said to her, how many classes do you teach a week? So twice a week. How much time? 30 minutes. And so I was just like, wow, you know, that's a big ask.
Yeah.
I said, you know, go ahead and try it. You know, just do what you can, but, you know, realize that they're asking a lot of you.
I think that's such a valuable thing to note. And I definitely learned that going from my first year of teaching Spanish to my second year is that my first year I was, you know, okay, each week I'm going to bring a new story. You know, it's just so crazy. And I think that the students felt the franticness. And because it was in another language too, there was never enough time for them to sink into it. And so then the mm-hmm. second year, I found one story that they really liked. And I did it with first through third grade. And with first grade, we drew, I had all these pictures to go with each part of the story and we'd recite the whole thing together. And then they would make their own flip book of the story. And then the second graders, you know, did a performance of it. And it was like, we oozed through the same story for months and they loved it. And it was incredible. It was an incredible lesson for me to learn that I think that the curriculum in a Waldorf school in so many ways is so vibrant that it can overpower the experience of a student in the classroom with an adult who's bringing them something. Even if it is the same something, that there is real power in that just presence. And I think sometimes just because the curriculum is so inspiring, you know, and in so many ways you want to cover everything. But I found that I felt so much more successful when I really slowed down the content and like really let them sink into it. And by the end they could, you know, I last taught Spanish in like 2018 and I still have parents who are like, Señora Ere, you know, you know, like my kid's in seventh grade now and they still sing Mi Cuerpo, you know,
yay.
But you know, but that I think that was such a valuable lesson. And I think it's one of the gifts of being a Waldorf teacher is that you get to slow down. And you get to say,
yes, I agree.
You know, oh my gosh, I don't have this pressure of there being an assessment at the end of the year where I will be evaluated on how effectively these students memorize the information I gave to them. Right. And we can really broaden our understanding of what does it actually mean for a student to have learned something. So.
But I think it's more subtle than that, though, because, you know, if you ask me, you know, was I fluent in German? Or if I ask you, were you fluent in Spanish? The answer was, yeah, once I started living in that culture for at least a couple months.
Yeah.
And so it strikes me that any second language curriculum in a Waldorf school, you are actually, the lessons are over the course of many years. I mean, it takes years to put the language into your muscles and bones and then to recall that requires a specific set of circumstances where it's kind of dormant and asleep until there's actually that finishing, what we talked about earlier in our conversation, that finishing moment where you go to and live in Mexico or Germany and you start dreaming in the language. That was very poignant for me when I started dreaming in German and stuff like that. So
yeah.
I think, you know, well, it's true, like language teachers are not main lesson or teachers, But it's somehow the lessons seem to be on like a longer cycle than, than, you know, just botany over 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Because you're really, if it's set up right, you're doing Spanish or whatever language, you know, for years, up to 12 years or more. You know, I wish I could teach science for 12 years. We might get into the 20th century if that happened.
Also, really quick, just to follow up, the book that you're referencing, Rosa, it's The 12 Senses, and the author is Albert Sossman.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just for anyone who's interested, it's a really fascinating book.
Yeah. One of the things that when we used to, when I first started working at the Waldorf School, is the subject teachers, special subject teachers. What do you call them now? Subject teachers?
Yeah, yeah.
Specialty teachers, subject teachers.
Thank you. We had a meeting. We would get together once a week. It was great. You know, there is a danger in Waldorf schools to overeat. But at the beginning, it was wonderful because we were all, you know, this is where we got our mentoring. We mentor each other and talk to each other. And one of the things that I love that stayed with me from these gatherings was this perspective that we got, that the class teacher's gesture is this, you know, there's a depth, it's up and down, you know, because that's the class teacher reaches the student's learning capacities or psyche or whatever you want to call it like that. But the subject teacher is a horizontal line because we see the scope, the whole width of the student and where they're going from first through eighth grade and all these different students. Whereas a class teacher has this one group that she's dedicated to or he is dedicated to, and they really have to go in deep. We get to do this.
Wow.
And I think that that's just a perfect description of Waldorf, you know, this getting all sides, you know?
Yeah. That is a really, like, a really beautiful thing. And I think that there is also, you know, the relationship with a class and their class teacher can be so deep and so almost parental in nature. That there can be something then, I think it's really nice then to have kind of this one extremely intense central relationship and then also to go into, either to go into a subject classroom or to have a subject teacher come into your classroom who then brings something
different. Was a fun aunt.
Yeah.
Was a fun aunt.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The fun aunt comes in, brings all the sugar, leaves you with mom and dad. You know, but I think it's a really amazing balance. And I remember there being a moment of becoming aware of the fact that it was really powerful to have this big network of adults who were devoting their life to teaching us. Like that.
When did you reach that realization?
I feel like maybe middle school was when I realized that. I don't think it, you know, necessarily had, you know, earth-shattering implications in my behavior and how I operated. But I think on some level, it was like, whoa, we're, you know, not only do we have this class teacher, but we have, you know, we have Miss Black, we have Miss Darcy, we have, you know, we have Senora Vela Sachs, we have Miss Herringer, we have all these people. We have our eurythmy teacher who, you know, God bless their souls, you know, with how wild we were. But that there was just this realization of like, I'm not sure that everyone has this, right? Of like, I don't know if everyone gets to say that they go to a place every day where all these people are looking out for you and, you know, teaching you, but also looking out for you. And
it becomes a family. It's a family.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. Wow. That's awesome. any other bits or pieces, any fun stories you remember? I mean, you're just such a wealth of knowledge. This is amazing.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm really grateful for the experience that I had to teach at that school and that I learned so much from it. Like I said, I think that that's really where I got my education. That before that, I might have known some stuff, but it was Waldorf that really educated me. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. And so willing to help anybody who takes that path through Waldorf education. It doesn't always have happy endings.
Yeah.
And, but you know, I think we have to make our own happy endings. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that they, Walter contributed a lot for me to be able to sit here in my house and have nothing to do.
So I actually realize I have another question for you, which is that something that was one of my favorite parts of being at the Austin Waldorf School was the pumpkin path. And you, in addition to being the queen of the universe, were also one of the queens of the pumpkin path. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about like the inception of that incredible event. I'll have you know that I took on the role of queen of the All Hallows Eve path in Santa Fe.
Yay!
And I dragged everyone kicking and screaming. My colleagues are like, Taylor, what are you doing to us?
Yeah. The festival life at the Austin Waldorf School was magical. I mean, and that was particular. I think that was the brainchild of Susan Darcy.
Yeah.
Who is magic herself.
She is.
And then with Fonda Black with her craftiness and then so many people involved. Your parents, the plastic masters.
Yeah.
You know, they would hang up those plastic shields. And
I remember Tracy DeLeo.
It was magic.
Ellen.
I think it was an opportunity for the adults to also have fun. You know, we were bringing this magic for the children that was outside of the school, but it was still stories and it was still very, very much in a very fantastical realm.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it was also very much for the adults, and putting it together was you're going to edit this, right?
Yeah.
then the actual presentation, I can't even begin to describe what we got out of it as performers. To have the kids the next day say, oh, weren't you? Blah, blah, blah,
yeah,
why, you know,
yeah.
Or like with the shepherd's play, when you do the shepherd's play and they don't know what you're going to be, and then the next day they come to you, oh, I saw you.
Yeah.
To live for those moments. And then taking it down was another where you got a chance to really go through it with the other adults. And these were the adults playing, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a bonus that the children got something out of it, but it was the adults playing.
Nice.
And then it just evolved. It got too big, didn't it? At one point it got really big.
Yeah. And I think
it's almost unmanageable.
I think that's, that's one thing. And I always have to check myself because I have being a child looking out versus being an adult kind of looking in, though I have to recognize that those things feel very different, but I had this feeling that in the time when I was at the Austin Waldorf School, there was still an element of that founding spirit and that there was kind of a founder's mentality of, I remember, and I think my parents dove into the community in a way that was very extraordinary. But, I remember my dad putting shingles on the high school. I remember us at the building lower school playground and being there. And I just, I remember being on campus, and that it was a place that we were all making together. And
schools evolve the way they develop, just like human beings and everything,
Yeah.
And you're right that we were there when it was still had that first, the initial or founder's spirit. But it has to evolve. It has to grow.
Yes.
I wonder how we could work, or how the system could work to keep that same sort of energy, because I think it does go away after a while, after the school becomes a little bit bigger or a little bit older.
Yeah. And especially when it comes to parent involvement and parent participation, when I took on the All Hallows Eve walk in Santa Fe, I was met with, my idea was, okay, it seems like there's been a struggle to bring people on board to do this. Let's put it in the hands of the high school and have it be something the high school does for the community. Mm-hmm. And I had one or two parents say, oh my gosh, you can't take away this, incredible volunteer opportunity from the parents. And so I said, okay, great. Next year, we'll send something out. Let's hear what parents are interested in being involved, and I'll send out a communication. And I reached out to about 45 people and only heard from one. There does just seem to be something different with community involvement, and how do you cultivate that? It's just such a question. It was just such a question for me. being in a different school and also having to say, okay, I was a kid, I had a perception, you know, that was very much from the perspective of a child, but I did feel like I just had all these memories of seeing all of these parents just pouring hours and hours and hours of time into creating, like you said, these magical moments, you know? And yeah, I could tell that it was an impossible feat to pull off. And you're right, it got way too big. You know, as soon as there were unicorns and centaurs and, you know, and then we did the perilous path that one year and, you know, it just got massive. But that, man, as a kid, was that magical.
It almost had to be a thing on its own. It couldn't be, I mean, when I started, it was teachers working with the parents too.
Yeah.
And then towards the end, it became, the last time I did it, which was, I think, 5 years ago, it was all parent led.
Yeah.
At the Nelson Walter School. It was wonderful. I mean, it was a great experience and they invited me to be part of it. And I said, yes. And I thought that I would see other of my colleagues there, but I was the only one.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it was really a different feel to it. Still wonderful, you know, and if it can happen, and if there's that kind of parent energy, that's great.
Yeah.
I don't know what's changing. You know, if it's the kind of parents that are coming to us, the kind of families that are coming to us, given that, you know, it's not a free education either.
No.
Unfortunately. And so it's costly.
Yes.
And that can be kind of a detriment to some people. That's also the reason why diversity is such an issue for the school.
Yeah.
You know? Although I've got to say that I think what we were trying to do, especially with the way that we were teaching with languages and the different things that were taught at Blocks and the different people that were invited to come to our school, you know, for different in fifth grade, you know, and in fourth and third grade, different people were invited to come. I think that was a way that we were doing diversity.
Yeah.
There's a danger that we get, I feel, when we try to make diversity be just this one thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And here I am. I don't want to be controversial about.
No, I think we've kind of touched on it a little bit of, you know, the trying to balance a really, really rich history in Waldorf education with certain texts, certain cultures that are explored in Blocks, certain pedagogical stories, balancing that with, you know, our maybe more modern global view, which recognizes the power of bringing more and more different, you know, different voices into the curriculum. Right.
Try to balance the different voices. Yeah.
Yeah. How do we balance that? And I think it's a really relevant question facing Waldorf schools now. And I think that's a question.
How do we attract those different voices? Because I think that's has been the issue. I mean, maybe now it's a little bit different. I've sort of been removed from the whole Waldorf movement for a while.
Yeah.
4 years, 5 years. But except for my mentoring. But how do we attract those voices? How do we attract the different voices that we want to?
Mm-hmm.
And the way we did it when I was teaching at the Austin Waldorf School was by inviting parents of different cultures to come and do presentations in the class.
Yeah.
Which I thought worked.
And I think that's where you start, right? Is within your own community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, who are the people in our community who bring other stories and who bring other voices, and how do we welcome them? Yeah, and I think that every, you know, almost like how second language emerges from the geography of a place, that diversity is going to look different depending on where you are.
Well, yeah, of course.
You know, and that, you know, I think that sometimes it's very easy, because we are so global, to view like a, you know, to have a really, really broad view of what diversity should look like, when the reality of a demographic group and where you are means that may look very, very different. And as it should. But I think what is desired is for the makeup of a Waldorf classroom to reflect the full diversity of the local community, not just one small portion of that local community.
I think that's a really exciting part of the new, you know, public charter Waldorf movement and the Alliance for Public
charter or public Waldorf education, in addition to the Association of Waldorf Schools, and the idea of accessibility through not having to pay tuition or a non-tuition based model. I'm really excited to explore that here on the podcast, but I have more conversations around that, because I think if we would lower the bar, for entry, and allowing, anybody to come who wanted to rather than who could just pay for it, that would increase diversity almost immediately. And anyway, I would just like to ask if there's any questions you have for us.
I was going to ask you if you have invited Kayla Buckley to talk to you about the public Waldorf movement.
Taylor's mentioned it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, he would be a great.
Yes.
Also, I don't know if you remember the Green Streets, Green Street and her husband and their son, Morgan.
Yeah.
He is in Africa right now doing something, and I thought, wow, he would be a great guest for you to see what his trajectory has been.
Interesting. I will definitely. So I've connected with Caleb Buckley and I'd send him an email, and I definitely have on my list to follow up with him because he's someone who immediately thought of.
Yeah. Somebody else who might be able to speak really well in that realm would be Tom Schaefer.
Mm.
I don't know Tom Schaefer.
He worked at the Shining Mountain at one time in Colorado. And he worked in California at different schools. And right now he's the one that's mentoring the school in Costa Rica. But I know that he instrumental in beginning a public Waldorf school in California in San Francisco.
Cool. Okay. So yeah.
He might be a good resource also.
Definitely. I mean, I think it's such an important part of the conversation right now. And a big part of me hopes that there will always be a place for both, right? That there will be a place for private Waldorf schools and for public charters, that there will be room for both.
Well, yeah. One of the things that needs to be explored in that question is also to what extent does the fact that right now a Waldorf school for the most part is costly, how much does that influence the parents involved in the school? Because, when I was in public school, my mother was in the PTA, but she was just one of the few people that were in the PTA. How, in order to be successful in a Waldorf school, in any school, but in a Waldorf school, I think the parents have to believe in what's happening and adhere to what the school is asking to help form the child. It has to be a partnership between the school and the parents.
And a commitment. And
so money is important, but there's also this other thing. Do we want Waldorf to be free for everyone and so nobody values it anymore? Mm. And I know that's a very, very
I think there's
flippant comment. But
I think there's an element to that. And I think some of the schools that, live in states where there's school choice, where they're exploring that as well of, interesting. There are people coming here who may not be as bought into some of the philosophical cornerstones, especially when it comes to media policies and things like that, that are increasingly important in distinguishing, and people are really coming to Waldorf schools in the hopes that that is something that is held, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And that, then to have maybe a parent body who isn't as invested in that can be really challenging for the parents for whom, and for the teachers who are kind of conducting their work under the expectation that that is something that's held.
Yeah.
Well, and it also affects the children, because when the child senses, and they're so sensitive, you don't have to say anything, they'll sense it. When they sense a schism or a disagreement between their parent and their teacher or two teachers, they know.
Yeah.
And it really affects them. So
that's so true. that's so true.
Well, thank you so much for asking me to be here.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been an incredible conversation, and I think it kind of sheds light on a part of, a really important key piece of a child's experience in a Waldorf classroom that we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah. And what's interesting to me is every time we talk about one facet of the Waldorf curriculum, it's like, this is the most important one. And then we talk to someone about this is so important and mm-hmm. this is so important.
And
it's a diamond with all these facets.
Yeah.
It is.
Rose cut diamond.
And that the individuals in these lanes are bringing so much value and enthusiasm into what they're doing.
And creativity. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And each one thinks they're the most important. Works the hardest.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Rosa.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Would you like to be a sponsor on Hard Beeswax? Email us at hardbeeswax@gmail.com.
That concludes another episode of Hard Beeswax. Thanks for listening. For episodes and more, please visit our website, hardbeeswax.transistor.fm.